And good evening, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to Your No Show, the Blog Talk Radio program on the Renford Broadcast Network that addresses New Thought Metaphysics, which simply means a new way of thinking as we move beyond the physical and discuss the metaphysical aspects of spiritual intervention that incorporates the wisdom of yesterday with the technology of today and allows us to bridge the gap and circumnavigate the spiritual highways of yesterday, today, and tomorrow. My name is Robert J.V. McMillan, and it is my pleasure to serve as your host and to invite spirit-filled people to share with us how it is that they are showing up in the world, how they are making a difference in their neighborhood mosque, temples, churches, synagogues, and even the neighborhood 7-Elevens, and then taking that to their states, countries, and ultimately to the world. My guest this evening is a dear friend from many, 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 many years ago. Dr. Maisha Hazard is an innovative educator, a behavioral change communication specialist, a speech writer, media consultant, and New Thought minister. She holds advanced degrees in communication, transpersonal psychology, behavioral science, and counseling. And she is a woman of travel. She has been to so many countries that sometimes she meets herself coming and then tries to figure out what it is that she's going to do when she leaves there to go somewhere else. Actually, Maya always knows exactly where it is that she is going and what she is going to do, because Maisha Hazard is the daughter of a mystical, metaphysical minister, a United Methodist whose PhD from Temple University was in sacred theology. From him, she learned both scholarly and mystical approaches to spiritual investigation and practice. From her mother, she learned loving kindness. Maisha was ordained in religious science at City of Angels Church of Religious Science and Emerson Theological Institute in New Thought Ancient Wisdom at the Agape International Spiritual Center, and in metaphysical ministry by the International Metaphysical Ministry, IMM. In other words, my guest is just an awesome, awesome lady, but most of all, she is a dear friend, and she is a lover of spirit and a lover of people. Good evening, Maisha. How are you?
Good evening, Robert. I'm good.
I'm glad to know that, and I welcome you back to the No Show. You were here such a long time ago. It's been almost seven days and this hour. So I am pleased to have you here. We wanted to bring you back because there was such a demand from people wanting to know about life and about love and about peace and about joy, but about especially the subject that we're going to cover, which is part two of our conversation from last week. They want to know how to express nonviolence and how it was that all of the folks like Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. and Mahatma Gandhi and so many others were able to transcend personal feelings of wanting to get back, pay back, and to then move forward for the benefit of all humankind, for the world, in order that we might move forward. So I wonder if we might just start, Mike, with your sharing with us a little bit of how it is that you got into this field, what it is that drew you, and give people just a little touch of last week for those who were not with us so that they have a clear-cut understanding of the conversation. And ladies and gentlemen, let me also share with you that should you have a question or if you want to make a comment, simply press 1 on your phone, and then we will bring you into the conversation, because that's what this is. This is a meeting amongst friends, and we want to hear what it is that you have to say. We want to hear your questions, and we recognize and realize that the collective consciousness of any speaker's audience on any given subject is always greater than that of the speaker. So please, please, please press 1. If you want to make a comment or ask a question, you have to do that, you ladies and gentlemen that are online with us. You actually have to call in if you want to ask your question, but you can put it into the chat window, and I am monitoring that as well. Dr. Hazard, please share with us what it was that made you move in this direction and what it is that is exciting about it for you.
Well, I have to say that my parents threw my sister and me into the deep waters of the civil rights movement when we were young children in elementary school. As a matter of fact, I started elementary school, I started first grade, first time going to school, in what I call my father's integration experiment. And there were seven little African-American children from ages 5 to 8 who integrated an elementary school on the eastern shores of Maryland. And a lot of people don't think about Maryland as being like Alabama, Mississippi, and Arkansas. But it was as southern as those three states I just mentioned, had the white and colored only signs. We could only go to the library once a week during the hours for colored people. And at the movie theater, you had to sit upstairs. So that very first year, at the age of 5, that's the age I was when we began our nonviolent direct action classes. I don't know that they called them that then, but that's what they were, where they were teaching us what we would have to do when we were mistreated by the children at the school, that we had to be nonviolent. We had to endure whatever happened, but look the other children in the eye. We had to have the force of spirit, is all I can say, to withstand what might occur during that year. And after first grade, after that first year in school, we moved to Philadelphia. And while Philadelphia is not usually thought of as a state with segregation, de facto segregation was very much a part of the city of brotherly love called Philadelphia. And my father would take us sometimes on the weekend, on Saturdays in particular, out to look at houses that were up for sale in communities that had the covenants in the mortgages, or the covenants in the deeds, I should say. And the covenant, for those of you who don't know, was a statement in the deeds that the houses could not be sold to African-Americans or, in some cases, to Jews, to people of color and to Jews. So we would dress up and go look at houses. Sometimes we got in, sometimes we didn't. So I was very much involved in the civil rights movement, although I was still a child. I was present when my father led a group to sit in at a Holiday Inn in Greensboro, North Carolina. I was still in elementary school when that happened. He was teaching summer school at Bennett College in Greensboro. So that's how I got involved in all of this. I received my first training in what to do in those kinds of situations at the age of 5. So there you have it in a nutshell. Okay. It's a practice that has been a part of my life since then. It seems as if through much of my life I've been thrown into situations where I would have to deal with integration of some kind, whether it was being the first an African-American woman on faculty at a university in a particular school or department, whether it was going to high school. I went to a high school just as I was getting ready to have fun and go to high school. My father decided to move us into a suburban community on the main line of Philadelphia. The neighborhood that we moved into was one where an African-American physician and his family moved the year before we moved in, and they were run off. Their windows were broken, they were stink bombed, they were harassed, and finally they sold and moved. So I have a little bit of experience, and that's how I got into it.
I appreciate that. Yeah, you have a lot of experience, and of course you and I met in Little Rock a number of years ago, and it was my pleasure to know your father, Dr. Walter R. Hazard, and your mom, whom I called Mother Hazard. and to sit at that table and listen to so many of the discussions of that particular time. And I think that's what people also need to understand, is that there were discussions around everything with all of the children that involved them at a level of their understanding, so that they would be aware and not that they wouldn't necessarily be afraid, but to be forewarned is always to be forearmed. And so going to Little Rock Catholic High School myself, and although there were more of us there and we didn't have the challenges with integration, we still had the problems with integration, meaning that although we were going to a school that supposedly had embraced everyone with open arms, everyone that came from there didn't come from a teaching of that. So that's one of the things that we want to talk about this evening, Dr. Hazard. We want to talk about how it is that you all as children perceived some of those challenges, like you talked about a little bit last week, but also how your mom and your dad prepared you and others to go into spaces and places like that, like people were prepared in the movie Selma. You know, people saw that and they were, some people were really challenged with that. Let's stop there. Let's park there for a moment. How applicable do you feel the movie Selma was to your real life experience?
Well, there were things that people went through in Selma that I didn't directly experience. You know, getting hit in the head and you know, marching. I did not march in Selma or anywhere else. But I love the movie because the movie does bring to us the spirit of the times. The one thing that I found missing in the movie was the depth of the spiritual preparation that people had before they went on any of the marches. I mean, I know when my father was leading the group to the Holiday Inn, I think it was 1961 or 62, I'm not sure exactly, in Greensboro, there was a lot of prayer that took place before that. Folks were deeply dropped down in knowing where the real power is, that there's only one power, one presence, one life, one source, and that there was that time of aligning themselves with spirit, of really, and people had very deep faith and a real understanding that one with God is a majority, or if God be for you, there can be none against you. And when you say that Bible verse, if God be for you, there can be none against you, it doesn't mean that there aren't some people who are trying to come against you. It just means in the long run, they have to stop because they can't really come against you, and they can't continue a battle against you when you are standing in alignment with the all and all. I can remember hearing people recite the 91st Psalm, the 23rd Psalm, the 27th Psalm. And for those of you who aren't into the Bible, you know, the 23rd Psalm is, "The Lord is my shepherd, I shall not want." And there's that whole phrase in there about, "Yea, though I walk through the valley of the shadow of death, I shall fear no evil, for thou art with me." You know, people really having a sense of that. People having a sense of living under the shadow of the Almighty, which is from the 91st Psalm. Or the 27th Psalm about fear, you know, about really getting over your fear. So people sang affirmations, because I know a lot of people in your audience are in New Thought. They're in Unity and Religious Science and other offshoots from that. And it's so important for folks to know that people were singing their affirmations. It wasn't the first time that African Americans had done that. Clearly, slavery would not have ended if folks had not come to a deep understanding of their spiritual nature, how we fit into this universe, and what our relationship is to the Creator. And the spirituals that people sang during slavery were the same songs that were sung during the Civil Rights movement, and they were affirmations. And someone told me a number of years ago that prayers that are sung are more powerful than prayers that are simply said in our speaking of them. And that's because when we're singing, when we're caught up in the music of it, caught up in the melody, caught up in the emotion of the song, we are not dealing with our faith and with our spiritual understanding from our heads, from an intellectual standpoint. But we are really speaking or singing the affirmation from the heart. And let me tell you, in some of those prayer meetings that we went to before we integrated the school, the hair would stand up on the back of your neck. The spirit was so palpable in the room, because people understood that we were going to have to be covered by something greater than the anger and the hatred of the individuals who were coming towards us with the intent of violence, with the intent of intimidation. And though there were moments when I was afraid, I have to really say that most of the time during that year, I wasn't afraid. There were moments. But I left the house every day. I didn't even know that my mother was following us every day. I walked out in confidence because of the prayers of my parents every night and every morning before we left, the prayers of the members of the community who met every week for prayer meetings, not just on Sunday, but on days during the week. And there was a group of prayer warriors who were holding vigil for us through that entire year. I don't know exactly how it all worked, but I do know that my father had a group of people, and every third hour, at 3, 6, 9, and 12 during waking hours, there was a group that stopped at those hours, and they recited the 23rd Psalm, the 27th, and the 91st, or other psalms that my father also assigned people. And they prayed. So it was a very disciplined movement. And I know that that's true about the movements led by Dr. King and Dr. Ralph Abernathy and many others. There was a deep spiritual discipline, not only a spiritual discipline, but there was the teaching of self-awareness. You know, so the folks would understand the role-playing, so that you would understand what your reactions were emotionally. And you would find ways to redirect the energy of anger. Anger is not a bad thing. A lot of people think that something's wrong with anger. But it's really a gift that we have. Anger is really an inner message that comes to us that says, whatever's going on right now needs to stop. You need to do something about it. A lot of people feel the anger, and their first instinct is to try to beat up whatever it is that made them angry. Whereas, I believe the purpose of anger is that you get an extra boost of energy to direct towards something that is productive, towards something that really gets you going in the direction that you really want to go in. A lot of people just use it as the energy to fight or to run or to complain. But when you understand that the universe gives us this extra energy, by the time you get angry, things have gotten to the point where you haven't done anything about it before that, but now you're at a point where it's like, okay, I can't stand it anymore. I'm going to do something. So the movement was very much centered in self-awareness and self-mastery. And so there was discipline. That's what the classes were all about, teaching us to understand our feelings and teaching us to be able to direct the energy so that, for example, in situations where perhaps you have a teacher who is always making it seem like you can't learn. My first grade teacher told my parents I was mentally retarded and that I would never learn to read. And the truth is, I went to school reading. All the children who were chosen to integrate that year were chosen because folks knew that we had the support of a very strong family, and we had people who had taught us and knew that we were prepared. So I think it's real important for people to understand the role of discipline. I was listening to Congressman John Lewis a few days ago, and he was talking about the same thing, how the use of nonviolence as a methodology, as a practice, as a weapon, as Mahatma Gandhi called it, requires that we learn how to do it. It's not something you just wake up and know how to do. The most natural thing for a lot of folks when somebody does something to you is to strike back or to run or, you know, to react in some way. To learn to take what may at first be abuse and not back off, but to look the people in the eye, really takes some discipline and training. I mean, you learn how to do that. So that if you have someone who doesn't think much of you, someone who, and boy, have I seen this one a lot, when I joined the faculty at Ohio University back in the early 80s, there were several white faculty members who decided that I was really only there because of affirmative action, and that there's no other way that I could have gotten in, that I probably couldn't write a single coherent sentence. I actually heard one of the professors telling a graduate student, well, I bet she can't even write a coherent sentence. And I was like, okay. So what I did was I channeled that anger, that my emotional reaction, into making a point, proving a point. I had a class in grad school where when I got to the door of the classroom, the professor looked at me and said, you might as well go drop this class. There's no way you can pass it. And I'm looking at him like, you don't even know me. And he said, go drop it. You can't pass this class. And I said, well, I need this class. If I don't take this class, the classes I can't take next term. So I've got to have it. So I walked on in the classroom, and he just shook his head like, okay. So what I did was I channeled the energy of my emotional reaction into mm-hmm. what I was going to do in that class. So
sure.
Let me add the spiritual discipline that was part of it, and then I'll be quiet and you can ask me a question. What I did in that particular class was for every hour of studying, I spent 20 minutes in meditation and affirmation. So my affirmation was, infinite intelligence in me knows everything there is to know about this subject. Infinite intelligence knows everything in all of the books and the journal articles that we are assigned. And infinite intelligence knows all the questions that this man's going to ask on the midterm exam and knows the answers he's looking for. And as well, I visualized a bright red 100 under my name on the midterm exam. And I said, infinite intelligence knows everything I need to know in order to have this 100 A+ on my midterm exam. And as I studied, what happened was just before I went to class to take the exam, I got a flash. Something said, go back and look at, I think there were like 6 or 7 articles, journal articles. Look at those things. Look at these pages. I went back and I looked at them, and I was actually late going to class for the exam, and I was like, oh, boy, this man is really going to be upset. I walked into the classroom, and something told me to go and sit right in front of him so that my desk where I was sitting to write the exam was directly in front of his desk. And I sat there, and as I opened the exam, all of the questions were about the things I was told to go back and read. So I did get my 100, just to come to a close on that. So it's what you do with the energy. You got to have a plan. You have to have a vision. You have to have a goal. You have to have a result that you're seeking. The civil rights movement, there was a clear goal. There were clear results that folks were looking for. There was a vision.
I want to address something that we didn't get to complete last week, because there was a young man who expressed some concern for thinking that what we were saying in terms of nonviolence and turning the other cheek and so forth and so on was not also with an awareness of how it was that the progressive, positive people who held their own were also necessary in that movement. And so we at one point, when we get to that, I want to address nonviolence and violence, because his statement was, there is a time for each. There's a time for violence as well as there is a time for nonviolence, and how do we bridge that gap, which is a great question. But I want you to stand by for a moment, Mai, because Ms. Carrie has been waiting patiently for us to get to her out of California. Good evening, Carrie. How are you, my dear?
I'm doing great. Thank you for taking my call.
It's my pleasure. How could I not? What are your thoughts in terms of this subject of nonviolence and violence? And I know that from your history, you have some examples of violence, because you are one of the panelists and guest panelists on this program often, and you've shared with us. But what are your takeaways from this experience? What statements do you have, and any questions, Carrie, as well?
Okay, well, I'm really impressed by the level of self-awareness that it takes to stand up in the face of such, I want to say hatred, but I don't believe it's hatred. I believe that it's fear and misinformation. And the fact, you know, last week when your guest talked about how her mother was able to look men in the eye who were holding acid and lie, ready to pour on defenseless children, and she had no weapons, and they moved out of her way. I'm like, that's what I'm talking about. That's the kind of power I'm talking about. Like, when we have that kind of self-awareness to know that we carry that kind of power, you know, guns, knives, and all this other foolishness can go, it will be obsolete. And I'm really so happy that this is a conversation that we are having. But just like your other guest, about when do we know how to cross the line when, you know, words of excuse me with power don't get the movement that we need, and we do need to defend ourselves and protect ourselves.
Absolutely. Excellent. And you're exactly right, because, you know, having been in the military, I was trained to kill. I was trained to protect, but also to, as a last resort, if necessary, take a life. And when we think about our children, and we think about all of the things that they mean to us, to place them in harm's way, although I understand that it is for the cause and for a good cause, that that does take quite a bit. So perhaps the question, and thank you, Carrie, I'm going to leave your mic live. I'll come back to you in another moment for additional questions. But perhaps the question is, how do we get that kind of power that Carrie is talking about, that allows us to place our children as well as ourselves in harm's way? That's number one. And then number two is the question that the young man asked last week. Where does violence fit into the equation? How is it that we are to stand up and, if necessary, defend to the point of eliminating someone else as they are trying to eliminate us or our children?
Okay, well, I have to tell you that where I stand is in nonviolence. I mean, purely so. Because I do think that there is the force of spirit that we all have that can actually be used against those who are coming towards us with violence. When I was living in Little Rock with my parents, my father was president of Philander Smith College, United Negro College Fund School in Little Rock. And in the last 3 years that we were there, there were members of the white community that really came up against my father in a major way. I don't know if you remember, but there was one night, Robert, when you were dropping my mother and me off at the house. We had gone out to dinner. And as we arrived at the house, there were deep tractor-like tracks around the house, dug into the grass around the house. You could tell that a truck or a tractor or something had circled the house over and over and over again. And the front door, which was painted white, had black handprints and black footprints all over it. And you could tell that somebody was trying to kick it in. And I remember as Mother and I were getting out of the car, we were trying to decide whether we should try to go in the house or whether we should go call the police. We weren't really sure what was going on. And my father opened the door and said, "Get in here. Come on, come on. Come quickly." And when we got in the house, my father told us that he called the Little Rock police every 90 seconds to 3 minutes for an hour and a half, and the police never came. Okay. None of the guards on campus ever came. None of the it was almost as if everybody disappeared because they saw what was going on. It was a truckload of white men with shotguns who had circled the house. Now, they were doing this because my father had been given an order not to build anything new on that campus because there were people who wanted the land that the school was built on. And so he had been told that they were going to take the land, they were going to take the campus, and the school was going to close. And my father went and found money to keep the school open. I'm not trying to get into the full range of things about that situation because there were many, many things, including the fact that people threatened to kidnap my mother and threatened to do untold things to me. We got threatening phone calls for about a year and a half. The story goes on and on. But the point is that with all the threats that came, the spiritual discipline that my father, my mother, and I had was so serious. You know, we were doing the every third hour, but we were doing more than that. We were covered, spiritually covered. It's possible to do that. Now, not everybody enters into the discipline that it takes, the spiritual discipline it takes to do that, but I do believe that it's possible to sidestep violence altogether. Now, at the same time, we can look at the civil rights movement and know that when folks talk about how no revolution is won without violence, and that's not necessarily true. Violence came from, if we talk about India, for example, violence came from the British, but not from the Indian people who were using Satyagraha, the soul force. And so the revolution was won. Now, with the civil rights movement, yes, there were individuals who were standing at bay, who were prepared to use violence. We can look at Elhaj Malik El-Shabazz, Malcolm X, and the Nation of Islam at that time. And the interesting thing is folks talk about how willing they were to use violence, but we have no record whatsoever of any time that they used it. There's a difference in being prepared in a defensive stance and actually going on the offensive or picking up the guns. The number one thing about the Nation of Islam is that they are disciplined. They were then. I don't know what they do now. But at that particular time, they were disciplined. That's why they could take hardened criminals out of the prisons and teach them self-awareness and self-mastery. So that it's the same thing in Asian and African martial arts, where you're taught all of the things that you could use in violent defense. But the goal, really, is to never have to use it, to always be able to step aside, to use the chi, the power of chi, to avoid having to take another life, to be able to master. Once again, it's self-awareness and self-mastery. So that's really what I saw in practice. It's what I know my mother did on a number of occasions, which she stood up to, and my father as well. I was with my mother more than I was with my father because he was out in meetings and, you know, doing whatever it was he was doing professionally. But I saw her activate the satyagraha, what Mahatma Gandhi called, which is steadfastness in truth. And the truth is, there's only one power, one presence, and one life. The truth, with the capital T, is that we are one with all people. And the truth, with the capital T, is one with God is a majority. Now, for all the New Thought people who are listening, my question is, what do you really believe? What do you really believe? Either it's true or it's not. And so if it is really true, then that means that there is a way in which we can stand with truth force, with soul force, in such a way that we will never have to pick up arms to kill anybody else. Now, I know, generally speaking, in this world, it's very difficult to get past the conditioned and socialized belief that ultimately, if folks cross a certain line, then you're going to have to pick up a gun and kill them. You're going to have to pick up and defend yourself. I believe that it's a difficult thing, it's a challenging thing, but I do believe that it is possible for every human being to find that place of truth within and face anything.
Yeah, I agree with you. I agree with you. I think that you are exactly on the money with that, that it is possible. But I have people saying, but we are not there yet. And, of course, we would say, as ministers, as those who are involved in the things that are necessary to get to that frame of mind, we would say, well, let's get there, and let's get there together. But one of the other things that we call that, Maisha, is moralistic existentialism. In other words, people have a tendency at times to justify whatever it is that they feel they need to justify in order to justify where it is and what it is that they're doing. We have another gentleman that wants to come into our conversation.
Okay.
Mr. Cecil, I want to bring in our phenomenal RBR director of technical support. And Cecil, good evening. How are you, sir?
Excellent. How are you this evening?
Doing
to
great,
the guests
thank
and the host, how are you both?
Doing well.
Cecil, you hail from the Memphis area, and you are a couple of days over 10, 11, or 12. How have you perceived things in the Memphis area as a professional musician, as an educator, and someone doing all of the things that you do? How have you been able to move around being and becoming violent and maintain a nonviolent state of being? Can you share that with us?
Well, sure. It is my belief that I don't have to resort to violence in order to express myself and get things done. And I have been able to do that without having to do so. It's not to say that some people are not violent or do all that they can to push you to that point, because some people thrive on that energy. However, seemingly that since I've gone out of my way to vibrate peace and harmony, it has come to me, you know. Sometimes when people go out looking for trouble, they do find it because they're vibrating that, and it is manifest because that's what you desire, you know. And sometimes we are consciously aware of it, sometimes we are not consciously aware of the fact that we are actually vibrating the energy that we bring to ourselves.
Interesting. And how has, are there any examples that you can think of? Because I know as you were saying that, Cecil, I can bring to mind a couple of times that type of energy helped me to maintain my calmness, and I can remember a couple of others when it caused me to throw a right hook. But can you remember any of those times when that you're talking about that will help our listening audience to understand perhaps something that they've been involved in or that they will be involved in where they will be able to utilize the energy of spirit that is within to squelch a situation?
Well, as a boy, I was a little boy, and I remember the day that Dr. King was killed here in Memphis. A man who stood for nonviolence, and his campaign was all about nonviolence. And he died a most violent death right here at the hands of a violent individual. And as a result, lots of violence began to erupt here in the city, even to the point where the city was under martial law and they had the tanks rolling up and down Highway 61, which is also 3rd Street in Memphis, if anybody familiar with Memphis. And the tanks were actually rolling up and down the streets and occupying the city, and pretty much, especially the black community. But we had to conduct ourselves in a manner, whereas even though they killed King and we didn't even know who they was at the time, we had to control ourselves and actually, now one of the things that taught me that anger is really, when you're in a state of anger, you're definitely not thinking, because the people were angry about the killing of Dr. King, but they were burning down the stores and the community and houses and things and that. They were vandalizing the communities in which they lived. And I said, anger must be a stupid thing at some times, because now you have nowhere to go, to stores, to this, at any other shop, because you just burned them all. Okay, you may have been angry at the proprietors, but you were also burning black stores, looting all stores that were in the community. You didn't just pick the white-owned stores or the Chinese-owned stores or this or that. You burned all stores. You looted all stores in the community, you know? So it helps to, when anger rises in us, for us to actually step back, take a breath, breathe, and think, you know, because many times when we're operating in emotion, logic and reason is usually absent or not present.
Right. Thank you. That's awesome. That is awesome. One of the things, Maisha, I'd like for you to follow up on that Cecil brought up for us, that came to my mind, is I'm wondering if Dr. King had not died, if Mahatma Gandhi had not died, if El Shabazz, Malcolm X, had not given over his life, and interestingly enough, he gave that over at the time when he had renounced violence himself. He had been that, but then he had gone to India and he came back
to Mecca. Mm-hmm.
And to Mecca,
mm-hmm.
and it was
mm-hmm.
then that he was had found who it was that he was. So my question is is there a space and a place for violence as well, or should we just say no? There is no way for that to be a part of society.
Well, you know, I've been clear about where I stand. I really do understand that other people have different ways of operating in the world, and so who am I to say don't do it and to judge folks on it? So nonviolence is where I stand. But I'd like to speak
mm-hmm.
about the assassination of Dr. King and Mahatma Gandhi. If I speak about Dr. King, first and foremost, by 1968, the tenor of the times had changed. The attitudes and beliefs and the ways in which people thought we should be operating to move things forward had changed. And we had stopped praying. I really do believe that had a lot to do with Dr. King being vulnerable in 1968. That at that point, he was not covered by a community of people who were holding vigil for his protection, spiritual cover. By in 1965, as the movement began to fracture, it was partly because folks had a goal, and the goal was voting rights throughout the South. And so the Voting Rights Act was ratified in August of 1965, and folks shifted and started looking at other kinds of goals, like, okay, we have the vote, but now we don't have any money. So you had the summer of 1965, the Watts riots, and a lot of other things happening across the country, because the truth of the matter was that the vote didn't solve all the problems, being
mm-hmm.
able to vote. That's for sure. But more than anything else, when you have a goal and the goal is reached, a lot of times people start going in their own directions, the unity becomes fractured. And so I'd say the same thing happened with Mahatma Gandhi. It seemed like the revolution was over, independence was a fact, and the spiritual discipline was no longer held, because the end result, as far as most people were concerned, had already been achieved. I believe that if we had had a clear notion of what the next points on the agenda were, and folks could have been held together in a consciousness of moving towards a vision, moving towards a goal, that things would have happened differently. But movements, I heard Kwame Ture, a.k.a. Stokely Carmichael, speak years ago, because he's been gone for a while, and he was talking about the problem when you have a movement that is a temporary thing with a temporary goal. Once it's met, things fall apart. But if you have a community that's organized to continue to progress, knowing that there is a long-term agenda, that the first thing that you accomplished was part of the short-term agenda, but there's a long, multi-generational agenda, then you're building in infrastructures within the community that allow for more things to happen in a progressive way. In other words, you get the vote, but then you start talking about black businesses, you start talking about education. And what happened beginning in 65, was folks went back to individual goals and objectives
mm-hmm.
rather than collective ones. And I believe that the same thing happened in India to a certain extent. And people who had been working with Mahatma Gandhi, Muslims and Sikhs, and Jains, who had been working with him peacefully, suddenly the Muslim community became enemies of the Hindus again. And part of that was orchestrated by the Brits, who insisted that independence would create two countries rather than a consolidated India. And so Pakistan, where we see all kinds of things going on right now, became the country that was set aside for Muslims. And India was essentially Hindu-dominated, and they became enemies. They had worked together for the independence. So I think we have to really look at some of the subtle things that happened that we may have missed. I see the same thing in South Africa. I worked in South Africa in 2002, and I had been working in the anti-apartheid movement from about 1977 until the fall of the apartheid regime. But what happened is, okay, Nelson Mandela was freed. They had an election. He was elected president. But the long-term goals were not present. I remember in 1988, I said I was giving my last speech at an anti-apartheid rally because I knew at that moment, and I was saying this to my South African friends, right now, the discussion should be about how you're going to make sure that the children who haven't been going to school over the last few years get all the gaps in their education filled in. How do you get them dreaming, holding the vision of being financiers and engineers and gemologists and on and on, taking over the professional roles within the country? You have to, where there is no vision, the people perish, is essentially
right.
What we're talking about here.
That's it. You are so right. I thank you for bringing up Nelson Mandela's name because we don't mention him often enough. And when we look at his life and the things that he gave up for his belief system, I think that's part of what we are saying here, ladies and gentlemen, that your belief system really defines your life. And, of course, if you build that belief system around spirituality and as you best understand it, then you will walk in a way that will allow for things to go. And so all of the people have not been assassinated. Nelson Mandela was not. There are others who have not. And so that is what is important. Maisha Hazard, stand by for just a moment. Mr. Cecil, ask you to stand by. Carrie, stand by. I want for the ladies and gentlemen to know that we have a tremendous amount of programs on the Renford Broadcast Network that we want for you to know about. On Thursday, the Progressive News Weekly show is on at 5:30 p.m. Central Standard Time, and all of our shows are Central Standard Time. That's hosted by Daryl Clark from New York, and it is moderated and co-hosted by Cecil McDaniel, who is on the line with us right now and who is also the Renford Broadcast Network director. And we are so grateful that he stopped by, took a moment out from his schedule to respond this evening. The Searchers Roadmap is hosted by Rhonda Harrison, who is my moderator. And she's up at Red Feathers Lakes, Colorado. And that, too, is on Thursdays at 1 p.m. Central Standard Time. And that's the oldest of our shows. And Rhonda is a healer, and she often hosts shaman from around the world, 9,000 feet up the mountain. All right. The Dream Vision 7 show at 3 p.m. Central Standard Time, again on Thursday, is hosted by Deborah Bouvet from Boston, Massachusetts. And she controls a network which broadcasts from an NBC station in Boston and from the Internet around the world over to over 125 countries. This evening at 8:30 p.m., you may attune your stations one more time, check in at the same number that you dialed in on, or go up online at the same space and get with James Renford Powell, the Laws of Material Wealth Personal Development Program, 8:30 p.m. Central Standard Time. And James has phenomenal people on that show to talk about spirituality and how it is that we maintain our materiality. Because it seems, at least it does to me, and my children tell me that all the time, that that's very important because they seem to continue to have their hands out all the time. So if you want to know about that, and I know that you do, please, please, please go up on www.blogtalkradio.com/Renford and check out all of the programs that we offer for you. We'll be glad that you did, and you will be glad that you did as well. Dr. Maisha Hazard, I'd like for you to share with us what it is that you are doing once you this week, this month, this year. What's next for you? You are a vocalist extraordinaire. You are involved in theater. You are a writer and an author. What is next for you? Where do you go from here? You also have a Blog Talk Radio program. Tell our listeners where it is that they might contact you should they need to do so, please.
Sure. At blogtalkradio.com, you can find us under Spiritual Activists. So if you just write in Spiritual Activists, and that's plural, you'll find our Blog Talk Radio shows. I'm on every Saturday morning at 8 Pacific Time, 8 to 9, and that's a show that's called Saturday Morning Wake Up Call. And we talk about spiritual activism, and we talk about activating the power that is within us, the power of imagination, the power of vision, the power of intelligence, just all the power that is seated in each and every one of us. And on Wednesday morning, 6:30 to 6:45 a.m. Pacific time, we have a chamber of prayer. And you can dial into that at 760-542-4331 is the dial-in number, but you'll see that online if you put in spiritual activist. And then on Sunday evening, my sister, Dr. Alexina, has a show called Heart Matters, and that's Sunday evening at 6 p.m. Pacific time, a one-hour show. Everything about the heart, about forgiveness, and about love. So we have an organization, an institute called KEPRA, Institute of Applied Metaphysics, and KEPRA is an Egyptian, ancient Egyptian or Kemetic term, K-H-E-P-R-A, KEPRA, and we teach classes about ancient wisdom and about science and spirituality, quantum physics and spirituality, and at different places, different community or spiritual centers around the country and overseas from time to time. That's basically
and you even respond,
what we're doing.
You even respond to friends that ask you to come on their radio stations, the Blog Talk Radio programs twice in back-to-back shows, week to week.
Yes.
And that is greatly, greatly appreciated. I want to share with our listening audience how grateful I am for you all taking time to stop by and visit with us. Cecil, thank you so much. Carrie out in California, along with Maisha, thank you so much. But this could not have been what it was this evening or last week had it not been for all of you saying, this is what we want to know about, this is important to us, we want to take this information and use it, do something with it. Maisha, I want to give you 35 seconds to close out and leave us with whatever thoughts you would like to leave us with in 20 seconds now, please.
All right. My main message to everyone is that there is a power within us that is greater than anything that's in appearance in the world. That power is creative intelligence. It's imagination. And we have to remember that we have to hold a vision of the results that we desire to live with, to experience. We have to have a goal. We have to have a vision. And remember that. That's first and foremost. Know where it is that we're going, what it is that we're holding is truth. And know that there's only one power, one presence, one life, living and moving and having its being in each and every one of us. And so it is.
And so it is indeed. Thank you so much, everyone. Go forth and make this the best week of the rest of your lives. This is only the beginning. God bless. Take care, everybody. Thank you so much, Dr. Hazard. Thank you, Mr. Cecil. Thank you, Carrie. Thank you, everybody. We'll see you next week. Take good care.